All right, it's 1 o'clock. You are in UMC 235, How Politics Derailed Science. It's panel number 5515, and we will go from 1 o'clock to 2:20. So that means we have lots of time for questions toward the end. And as usual, we try to have students ask their questions first. I have a statement I have to read about the apps that we now are using. So in this session, we'll utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select the session in the schedule, tap Live Q&A, and then insert your question. You may also raise your hand at any time to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. And if you are a student, please write student so we know, and we'll try to get your questions asked first. Excuse me. So I'm Alice Madden. I work here at the university. I'm the head of the Getches Wilkinson Center for Natural Resources, Energy, and the Environment at the law school. My background is an elected official. I was a majority leader and got to represent this great area in the State House. I was Bill Ritter's climate change advisor. I worked at the Department of Energy, Center for American Progress, and I've worked on these issues for a long time. So I'm so excited to be able to moderate this panel with these amazing folks. Their bios are in the program, so I'm not going to read those. I'm just going to do a really short introduction of each of them. But David Grinspoon is an astrobiologist and award-winning science communicator. He's a senior scientist at Planetary Science Institute and an adjunct professor at the Astrophysical and Planetary Science here at CU. And you're based in D.C. now, right? And Peter Fromhoff is the director of science and policy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. I think they're getting more concerned by the moment. As we speak. Peter's a global change ecologist and was a lead author on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, the fourth assessment that was published in 2007. And at the end, we have Dr. Garrett Verschuer, is a radio astronomer involved in research for over 56 years. His PhD is from University of Manchester in England, where he also is a huge fan of Manchester United, although now he lives in Puerto Rico, so there's a bit of a time difference. He's the former director of Fisk Planetarium here on campus. And I want to say he has the most truth in advertising in any bio ever read. When he said he was director of Fisk Planetarium, the next line is, after burning out on that job. he's delved into extraterrestrial radio signatures, figuring out how dolphins communicate, and he says he meandered, his word, back into astronomy. So I'm going to go rewrite my bio and include meandered in there someplace. So,
and burnout.
And burnout, yeah. I think we all have those, what we could do. So I get to be a bit of a fly on the wall here as moderator. I'll interject as needed. I don't think I will have to very much. We did have one other person you might have noticed. She had a conflict and was not able to be here, so we apologize about that. But gosh, there's certainly no vacuum of amazing thought right here on this panel. So David's going to go first. We're going to start with some kind of shorter opening remarks and then just have an awesome conversation, and we look forward to your questions. David.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming this afternoon. How politics derailed science.
Well,
I've been interested in science all my life and sort of knew from a young age I was going to be a scientist. And interested in the intersections between science and other cultural concerns and activities. As an undergraduate, I also got a philosophy degree in addition to my science degree. To me, this is a fascinating topic, and of course, recent events make it that much more charged. I was trained to believe, I was taught that science is value neutral. That's a term that is sometimes or was sometimes used to describe science. This ideal that science is just an interrogation of nature with no value attached. The scientists are, you know, sort of just the honest brokers who simply do experiments and analyze the results and try to figure out the nature of the physical universe with no attachment to any value or outcome and no motivation other than just curiosity and trying to figure out the way the universe is. That's a nice idealized picture of science, and of course it's not quite the way things really are. Science is not value neutral for a lot of reasons, and, you know, we could go spend an hour talking about those reasons, which we won't now, but of course, the history of science is one of involvement in political, you know, whether we like it or not as scientists, we, especially in our increasingly technological society, science is involved and sometimes implicated in developments and important issues of the day. In my own history, one of my first political experience of my life was being pushed in a stroller in a Ban the Bomb march in 1963 in Boston. And that the leader of that Ban the Bomb movement was Linus Pauling, the great chemist, Linus Pauling. And Linus Pauling is one of only two people ever to win two Nobel Prizes in two different fields. He won a Nobel Prize in chemistry and a Nobel Peace Prize. Do you know who the other person is who won two Nobel Prizes in different fields?
Yes.
Marie Curie. Yep, very good. Give that man a gold star. And everybody else who said it, too. Give them one as well. We got lots of gold stars. And you know, there's a reason why scientists got involved in the anti-nuclear weapon movement. The scientists from the Manhattan Project were motivated by fear of, you know, they didn't want the Nazis to get the bomb before we did, and that was a legitimate fear. They were working on it, and who knows what would have happened but had they got it. But at the same time, many of them right after World War II, and in some cases before Hiroshima and Nagasaki, became passionate advocates for nuclear disarmament. Philip Morrison was one of the people who literally helped load the bombs onto the Enola Gay for both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He helped load the bombs on, and he became a leader of the anti-nuclear movement afterwards. So, I mean, there are inescapable ways in which scientists realize they're implicated and therefore responsible. And we can go into, you know, there's a whole lot of cultural issues of science and ways in which it's not value neutral. You know, there are sciences, you know, of course, culturally determined in a lot of ways. There are gender issues and racial history and all this stuff that, you know, I don't think we can necessarily focus on, although we could come back to some of these things. But I want to keep my remarks brief. So jumping forward to the current day, we've established that science can't just consider itself value neutral and divorced from politics. And then, of course, in recent years, some issues, and most specifically the issue of climate change, has led to this real polarization of ideas about science and inescapable politicization of science, which a lot of us kind of regret, because while science is not obviously value neutral, there is a value in trying to pursue science with that ideal in mind, in the sense that there is a danger in pursuing science with an end result in mind. We have to try to keep ourselves honest. When you do an experiment, you don't want to say, this is the result I want to find. So that ideal of neutrality has a value in the practice of science, not necessarily in the communication of science. And that's part of, you know, we have to be clear. When we go and do our model and our experiment, we can't start off saying, I want to achieve this result because I want to prove this, because make this political point. That's dangerous. That's bad science. We have to see what nature's telling us the best we can. But at the same time, when we find a result, we can't just say, okay, I'm done, if the result is one that has great concern and relevance to a societal issue. And that's where the role of science gets difficult. Well, of course, with climate change, there's been this whole well-funded effort to discredit certain kinds of science, and that has provoked a reaction. And that's really challenging for science. The culture of science, I would say, it was not prepared for this. And it has led to, I mean, obviously, maybe not obviously, but just to state, I am a strong believer in the reality of climate change, and very concerned about that, and feel that scientists have a role in communicating about that and trying to move our society towards solutions and how we change our energy use and all that. And yet I do see that some of the people who agree with me, in response to the criticism, behave in ways that are not ideal. We do have this circling the wagons effect that we have to watch for, where we want to maybe downplay some of the uncertainty in what we know, because we don't want to create an opening for people to say, aha, uncertainty, therefore we don't have to act. It's very hard to communicate clearly and honestly about uncertainty, especially because scientists use those words in a different way than the general public does. So I think we have to kind of watch ourselves, even those of us who agree that climate change is bad and serious and want to communicate clearly about it, and guard against that circling of the wagons effect, and be honest about the fact the science is not settled. What is settled is we know enough to act. We know that the climate is changing. We know that humans are responsible for that. We know that it's dangerous, and we have to stop it and change our energy system quickly. Beyond that, there's all kinds of stuff we disagree about. About how good our different models are and how bad it's going to be, and that's good. Science needs disagreement. That's how we move forward. So it's very hard to be honest about both and clear about what we know. We know enough to act, and what we don't know, there's all kinds of dissent and disagreement. Just finally, right now, with this recent election and this new administration, we're in this even stranger time where just the notion that there is such a thing as evidence and that we can base conclusions and policies on it has somehow become some kind of a disputable statement, and just objective, agreeable, verifiable truth is under attack. Now, if you want to get philosophical, we could talk about, well, objective truth, do we really know what that is? And, you know, I mean, there are levels of interesting philosophical arguments about what do we mean by objective truth. But when Sean Spicer gets up and, or what's her face, Kellyanne Conway, talking about alternative facts, they're not talking about these subtle philosophical questions about what is objective truth. They're trying to confuse you, and they're being really dishonest. And so that makes me want to rally to the fact that and emphasize that, yes, scientists know certain things. We've figured out some things about the world that are important and that society needs us to communicate well about and people need to understand. And for that reason, I am definitely going to be marching in the March for Science on Saturday.
Thanks, David. Peter?
Okay. Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming today. So the title of this session is on how politics derailed science, and it implies kind of a past tense. And I want to just push back on that a little bit. I don't think science is derailed at all. I think science in this country in particular is robust. There's tremendous scientific research going on in this country. And science, I'm sorry, let me move this closer to my, so I don't think science has been derailed by politics. I do think that science, particularly areas of science like climate change, but many others that are relevant to policy questions that are important to protect public health and the environment, are very much at risk. At risk, not derailed, but at risk. And it's our job, my job, and certainly, and I hope many of yours, at least you feel that, to help make sure that doesn't happen. We're in a moment in time where, as David highlighted, of course, let's just kind of look, what are some of the ingredients of this, right? We have a president who seems to have difficulty with evidence and facts on a broad range of issues. We have a Congress and a post-Citizens United world, which is in many respects highly influenceable by vested interests, private sector funding, and the need to, or the perceived need to, raise money from particular interests in order to maintain their standing in office. We have a civil society which in many respects is distrustful of institutions and government institutions, federal government institutions in particular. And we have a communications environment in which, as you all know, we're living within our own, many of us, in our own bounded echo chambers of information sources that reinforce or validate our worldviews, and it's very hard to find a way to have evidence-based conversations relevant to public health and the environment that cross those boundaries. That's a very toxic mix in which this administration and Congress is currently operating. I do think that good evidence and science is essential to the functioning of our democracy. It's really what the Union of Scientists is about as an organization, and it's a privilege to be able to work on these issues in this moment, as challenging as they are. But let's also put this a little bit in a historical context. So I grew up in in Los Angeles in the 1960s and 70s. There was a lot of smog in L.A. then. I used to, as a kid, I would go run the mile at you know, in gym class, and my lungs would hurt after I ran the mile. It didn't occur to me until I actually moved away from L.A. that that wasn't a natural consequence of exercise, that your lungs hurt after you exercise. I mean, literally. But Los Angeles today is a very different place, right? There are many more people. There are many more vehicles, miles traveled in terms of automobiles. But because of the Clean Air Act, signed into law by President Nixon, and the science-based regulations under the Clean Air Act to motivate the reduction of pollutants, many pollutants, not all of them, including carbon, from tailpipes, among other things, fundamentally changed the environment in which kids grow up in Los Angeles and many other parts of the world, in the U.S. and the world today. And that was an example. And by the way, there was tremendous industry opposition to that. Oil industry pushed back very hard, said it's going to be too expensive, there's no way we can do this. You've heard these kinds of stories before. But evidence and science, on a bipartisan basis, won the day, and we're all better off for it. Public health is better off for it. And we've seen, you know, through the course of presidents leading up to today, examples where evidence and science have not won the day. It's not like it's a unique moment. It's certainly, we've seen versions of this movie before, including in Democratic and Republican administrations. I want to be clear about this. So, you know, President Clinton dismissed evidence about needle exchange programs and their value for managing and limiting the risks of AIDS because it wasn't politically attractive for him to do so, despite the strong evidence. Clearly, the George W. Bush administration, who's got our attention at UCS, with respect to a whole range of issues where science was politicized across a range of agencies and topics, including climate change, but including public health and many agencies, and where you had political appointees rewriting scientific reports, for example, many, many egregious actions. Which led a lot of it, got a lot of attention within the scientific community, and that pushback led to, among other things, the Obama administration coming in and doing some good things, which included establishing scientific integrity policies in multiple federal agencies, which we were privileged to help write, which ensured that scientists working in federal agencies had the right to speak to the media about their research, had the right of providing the last sign-off on reports that have their name on it, that kind of thing, which had, and they're, you know, they're variable in quality, but they do provide and they are still in place, they do provide a guardrail as a policy, not necessarily always enforced, to ensure that scientists and federal agencies are protected, their rights are protected as scientists. That's really important. But even the Obama administration also misrepresented science on a range of issues, on issues around contraceptives and Plan B, where they rejected a Plan B approval despite recommendations from the FDA, where the EPA under the Obama administration misrepresented evidence of risks of hydrofracking, fracking for chemical impacts on water quality. They downplayed that in the headlines of some reports that were released last year. So no administration has been. Science it enters into a political domain when public policy is being debated, and it can and does get politicized by a range of actors. What we're seeing now is, and I think what we're anticipating now, we're only, you know, we're, what are we, 80 days into the new administration, you know, we're seeing at the front end a lot of very disconcerting things. We're seeing a dizzying set of new policies being put forward particularly in the House, some of them now moving into the Senate, which are designed to reduce the role of science and scientific evidence in regulations. We're seeing executive orders, the Trump administration's executive order, for example, on eliminating two regulations for every new regulation you put forward, which is a kind of crazy notion, you know, where you might ask the EPA to trade off regulations around lead in drinking water in order to do another kind of regulation. It's a crazy idea, and yet it's signed into an executive order. We're seeing proposed budgets that deeply slash research budgets in multiple federal agencies, including but not limited to those like NOAA and NASA and EPA, which have essential roles to play in both informing our understanding of the Earth's changing climate and setting policies to reduce the risks of those impacts, among other things. And I also want to highlight that it's not just about topics that are in a narrow sense about science. So, you know, the immigration policies that we're seeing put forward, the Muslim ban, are having chilling effects on scientific discourse because it's such an international and diverse body of work. It's very hard to do science and to celebrate the values of science in with those kinds of constraints that are coming at us. So we're seeing scientists in other countries who would come here but are not. Now, you know, in going to talk about the Nobel Prize, in 2016, all six U.S. Nobel Prize winners were immigrants. Right? Our science has been built on the backs of immigrants. And diverse groups of scientists, there have been multiple studies that have pointed to this, much more diverse than this panel, I might add, produce more interesting, more robust over time and different kinds of results than groups of scientists which are less diverse. And so policies that affect sort of larger societal issues that are not in a narrow sense about science, those politics, and these are political, can also greatly damage science. And of course, the science within our federal agencies has built up over time, the scientific infrastructure that's built up over time can be easily unraveled when people leave. Part of what we're doing at UCS, and we'll talk more about it later, is basically let folks in federal agencies know we have their backs, encourage them not to leave, provide them with a place where they can come talk confidentially about what's going on, helping them shine light on misrepresentation or efforts to undermine their work. So I just want to close with this notion that what we're seeing now is the front end of obviously what a lot of us are concerned is going to become a fundamental unraveling of our federal science infrastructure and evidence-based decision-making. We're not there. We don't have to go there. I'll be marching next Saturday as well. So thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Peter. Garrett.
Yes, ma'am. I'm an immigrant as well, only 50 years, though, ago that I came here. So you can send me the Nobel Prize anytime you want. When I quit the planetarium, when I burned out, I was actually on the council, or the committee of the council on the Conference of World Affairs for 3 years. And when I finally left town, I expressed the desire to someday come as a participant, and it became an item on my bucket list. So today is the last day of my fulfilling that aspect of my bucket list. I'm going to talk about a completely different aspect of politics and science as viewed from the trenches, shall we say. Some of you already heard that I am now associated with the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico, which is a 1,000-foot diameter dish located amongst in strange hills terrain just south of Arecibo. And it's threatened with closure. So that is a political issue. Why close Arecibo when it's doing great science? And it is doing great science. And what triggered us last year to announce to the world just how great our science is was a press release put out by the Chinese astronomers saying, we've got a bigger dish than you do. And this is the so-called FAST, or you pronounce it FAST, I think, F-A-S-T. And it's going to be 1,500 feet in diameter as opposed to 1,000. And the press release got an extraordinary amount of coverage in the United States. And the reaction, our reaction was, we were overwhelmed with people saying, what's happened? Is Arecibo obsolete? And that wasn't just from our friends, but all sorts of emails came in, and some of the newspaper reporting of that press release was along the lines of Arecibo is now obsolete. Nothing could be further from the truth, but the damage it did to us was extraordinary, because the politicians would read the newspapers, the Washington Post had it, the New York Times, everybody had it. So that is politics affecting science in a way that most people are totally unaware of. But we had to fight that. So what happened after that was we said, well, we've got to fight it. And the American Astronomical Society had a meeting in January in Texas. So at the end of last year, we asked for a press conference at the AAS meeting. And I wrote some of the press releases myself as first drafts and discovered that some of my colleagues were doing incredibly interesting things. And we just hadn't publicized them. Because most scientists just do their thing, and then they hope that the world will pay attention when it finally gets published, and then by miraculous sort of diffusion that everybody will know about it. That's not what happens. One of the things I discovered about what had been discovered at the observatory was acting together with the Russian Astron spacecraft, which flies out almost to the moon and circles the Earth, and we combine the signal from Astron with the Arecibo dish to produce what's called an interferometer. And then you can measure very, very small angular diameter structures in radio sources. Now, for 50 years, we've known why radio sources emit strong radiation. It involves electrons spiraling around magnetic fields. It's called synchrotron emission. It doesn't matter if you don't follow the technical thing here. But the point is, if you know the angular size of the source and you measure the brightness that you're measuring with your telescopes, you can show what the actual physical mechanism is doing at the source. What the Astron experiments did with Arecibo was they discovered that the sources were so small and had to be so bright that the theory for producing the radio waves could not possibly explain it. So after 50 years of knowing why radio sources emit radio waves, suddenly they have these data from this Russian spacecraft and Arecibo working together saying, hey guys, you've got to re-examine your theories. So those observations are continuing, and for those of us who care about these things, that is incredibly important. And it's an experiment that cannot be done without Arecibo because of its huge collecting area. So we wrote press releases, and we had a press conference. It was very well attended, and we got quite a lot of coverage. But I don't think we ever undid all the damage that was done by the Chinese press release. So politically, in order for Arecibo to survive, we have to get the NSF wants to stop funding us, but NASA has to continue funding us. So there's this sort of strange dichotomy there. So we have to continue to let the politicians know, who have a say in all science funding, but how do you reach them? Well, you have to do it through press releases or press conferences, which is very, very tough. And I'll say something even more personal level about press conferences and media involving themselves with science. There is astronomers are very conscious of this. There's been a lot of publicizing your results by press conference, even before your results are published through the refereeing, the usual peer review process. This has produced some very embarrassing consequences. Last year, the year before, there was a claim that these particular people had discovered the so-called B-mode polarization, which showed that something was going on in the beginning of the universe, which was incredibly important. And then it turned out that they'd made a mistake. But it went all around the world. Media said, big discovery in cosmology, turned out to be wrong. They did that press conference before any peers had read their papers or reviewed them or approved them for publication. So this is happening to us all in astronomy. If I make a new discovery, if I want to have any chance of making it known, I have to have a press conference or a press release. And then I personally run into another barrier. First of all, if you write a good press release, the media love it because they don't have to do much work with it. So that makes it easy for them. But if they see, and this happened to me when I was at the University of Memphis, where I'd made a big discovery, as far as I was concerned, concerning cosmology, the media people would look at that press release and say, oh, get it for sure, University of Memphis? Where's University of Memphis? That's not Harvard, that's not MIT. We won't bother to cover that. So, or even worse, oh, he's from South Africa? No, that doesn't count at all. You know. So this politics and science has this whole other aspect which we in the trenches deal with, have to deal with. But the American Astronomical Society, which helps by setting up these press conferences, can't help everybody. So depending on your institution where you work, where they have a good press office, you'll get publicity. And publicity brings you recognition and grants. And in particular for the young scientists, publicity like that will help them get other jobs. So it's constant interplay between our objective science and having to somehow get the word out there so we can get funded for doing objective science. Thank you.
Wow. I know that's probably spurred some further...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's tricky, especially because as scientists, we're supposed to go through and look for the loose threads in each other's work. You know, if you write a paper, especially if it's significant and important and claiming something new, it is the role of your peers to try to find what you did wrong and publish papers pointing out what you did wrong. And if they do, and they're right about it, that's important, and you need to know that, and that's how science progresses. If they try to pick it apart and they can't, then maybe you're onto something. So there is this necessary picking apart that's honest, but then there's this dishonest picking apart that we have to suffer through because of this well-funded effort to derail science, and that just it's really confusing to separate those two. It's very hard for us. I think it's one of the reasons why this is a challenging time for the scientific community. I wanted to comment on one other thing, if I could, that came up in both of your comments. Garrett, you mentioned this collaboration between Arecibo and that Russian spacecraft, which just sounded really cool. I didn't know about that. And it made me think about the fact that science is inherently international, especially Earth science and planetary science. You know, we're studying the Earth and we're studying other planets, and it really doesn't make sense to do it in isolation. You can't do it really well in isolation. There's a long history of that. During the Cold War, the Russians and the Americans had separate space programs and were competing, but the scientists were kind of surreptitiously sharing information with their Russian colleagues and their American colleagues because we wanted their Venus missions to work, and they wanted ours to work, the scientists, because we wanted to know about Venus. And so there is this value. Scientists, of course, are motivated by all the petty, stupid things that all humans are, ego and greed and whatever, but we also do have a value of just wanting the answer, and that does lead us to transcend differences. Now, but unfortunately, you mentioned immigration, and there's been a lot of hassling of not just scientists, academics at the borders, and a lot of people turned away, and as a result, even worse, well, I don't know if it's worse, but it's as effective that people now deciding not to come to meetings. Colleagues are saying, I'm not going to bother to come to your astronomy meeting because I don't want to deal with the possibility of being hassled at the border. And there's an effect I think is happening, and I haven't seen this written about, but I think there's a brain drain from the United States that may already be starting, because I was just up at the University of Victoria in Canada. I spent a week there doing some teaching and speaking and stuff, and I met a couple of young American scientists who told me they had decided to start their careers there in Canada because they didn't want to deal with being scientists in Trump's America. And these are smart people who have the choice. They're getting offered jobs. They have the choice to go, you know, not everybody can say, I want to work there, not there. These are some of the really smart young scientists. And they're saying, I'm not going to go work in the United States. And I haven't seen anybody write about that. But there is really the possibility of brain drain and of, seeding our leadership in some of the non-obvious as well as some of the obvious ways in these important, crucial areas of figuring out the science of what's happening to the planet and how we had better responsibly interact with it.
Yeah, I totally agree. Thank you for that, David. Let me just make a couple of additional points. I want to talk about the responsibilities of scientists in this moment. And one of the things that happened after the election, totally understandably, but I think very corrosively, is that some scientists, particularly in federal agencies who were worried about what was to come, anticipating clampdowns, kind of put their heads down, right? So just as an anecdote, an example of this, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta was hosting scheduled to host a big meeting this past February on climate change and public health, all the ways in which climate change is affecting public health, a big international conference. Shortly after the election, they canceled the meeting. And they made no statement for why they did, but it's quite clear, and we've had lots of conversations with folks at mid-levels within CDC, is that they just thought it was a little bit too risky. They didn't want to put their heads up, and that's very dangerous. It's totally understandable, but it's very dangerous. And so a lot of our work is at the moment to try to buck folks up and encourage them to do their work and let them know that there are areas that they can come to in a variety of ways, both legal and in terms of public communication for support. I also think that we, as scientists, and this comes a little bit to what Garrett was saying, we have responsibilities to communicate our work in ways that go well beyond the peer-reviewed paper, right? I mean, especially for those of us who are funded by taxpayer dollars. I think we have a responsibility, all of us, to be talking about, not just in a narrow sense, the research that we just published, hopefully after we publish it rather than before, but about the reasons why science and research matters. And that doesn't have to necessarily be in a narrow applied sense, but rather also in a curiosity sense, right? That science matters, and to share that interest and curiosity and interest in having science matter in various public ways. And press releases and the media in a formal sense are certainly one, but in this, as David well knows from his work as a science communicator, there are lots of ways in which scientists can and I believe should be communicating social media and so on. It's tricky. You have to be careful to not, you know, as you move from a lengthy paper into a soundbite or 140 characters, you know, you don't misrepresent the fundamental nature of your work or imply that it has applications that in fact may go well beyond that research. There's an art to it. Scientists in graduate school typically don't get taught that art, but it's not unteachable. And a lot of folks are now engaged, including at NOAA and NASA, in training their scientists. We at UCS do a lot of training for scientists in various places to help them become better communicators. And I think it's really essential that we be out speaking about the value of science, the uncertainties in science, and the boundaries around that uncertainties, right? Because, I mean, David, as you said, science is not settled, that we know enough to act. That's absolutely true. But you have to be careful. I have to feel careful about the, you know, the meme, science is not
absolutely
settled,
absolutely
becomes a handhold for, you know, Lamar Smith, the chairman of the House Science Committee, use that as the basis for arguing that that broad areas of agreement among the scientific community on climate are in fact up for grabs when they're not. So again, one has to be mindful of how words and phrases that we understand might get used in different ways in different contexts by others with different motivations. I'll stop there.
I realize that I didn't complete what I should have said about FAST versus Arecibo. Arecibo is not obsolete because FAST cannot do what Arecibo can do. It does not operate at the frequencies that we operate. And they have not been able to make it work yet, despite anything you may have heard. The problem is that they have a very, well, how did they come to build this? Well, they sent a lot of Chinese astronomers to Arecibo about 10 or 15 years ago, who came with their cameras and photographed absolutely everything at the observatory. And then they built their telescope based on what they had seen. But their way of moving what's called the focus is to dangle it from these cables and move the thing around, and the surface moves up and down with huge actuators, and they have not been able to get any of that to work. It was too big a step, and I don't know if they'll ever get it to work. But anyway, they will never be able to do... 2 weeks ago, I was observing at 3 gigahertz, 3,000 megahertz, and FAST can only go to 1,000. So there's so many things that they're not going to be able to do that we can do. Therefore, closing down Arecibo is somewhat an insane idea.
So Peter brought this up, and I wanted to delve into this a little more, or let you all at least think about this. So a lot of the expertise that is connected to policymaking in the United States is within agencies. So Congress passes a law, and then an agency like the Department of Interior or the EPA takes several years to develop rules and regulations to implement that policy. It's a public process, and people, you know, the finest experts in the land get involved and develop these rules. Well, there is a little known rule called the Congressional Review Act. It's been used once prior to President Trump being elected. And what it does, it allows the Congress to do away, not amend, but completely do with an entire rule that was passed in the last 6 months of a previous administration. George W. used it on something Clinton had done, but like ergonomics, I think it was an OSHA thing. So it's been used once before. And the weird thing about this, too, is then that agency is forbidden from writing a rule on that subject without a specific congressional approval. So just guess how many times this administration's used it. 11 times so far, with two more on the books to perhaps do. So, and this is, you know, not just sort of this political nightmare, but, you know, a bigger worry about where will our expertise lie now? Is it going to shift over to Congress? Are they going to be the ones that now have to analyze how this is done? You know, where is our, you know, in addition to universities, and, you know, sort of the traditional science, I don't think many people know how much expertise is in agencies. And if they're not going to be utilized anymore, what does that mean? I feel like Typhoid Mary.
Yeah.
What's and the another next horrible thing we can talk about?
Another insidious effect, and I think it's it feeds back in a bit with what you're talking about, and I think you alluded to this, Peter, but is there self-censorship going on? People wanting to stay under the radar, and groups within agencies, I mean, every scientific agency to some degree is dealing with climate change, even if it's not their main focus. And I know people in federal agencies now who are saying, well, let's change the wording of this. Let's not call it climate change. Let's call it extreme weather. And, you know, and they don't want the hammer to fall on them. And so they're saying, we want to keep doing our work. So let's they're self-censoring a bit. But there's a dangerous aspect to that. It's like you're doing their work for them. And so I know that's the kind of thing you guys are working on. I'm glad you are.
Well, let me just say a word about it. Because, Alice, the Congressional Review Act is insidious in its recent applications, and it's only one of multiple tools, some of which are already in law and some of which are being proposed in legislation, and some of them, well, most of them aren't really getting a lot of attention,
no.
Right? These are not household names. You don't see them being discussed on, I don't know, Fox News. Forgive me. So I want to just give you a flavor for, here's one that just passed the House. It's called the Honest and Open New EPA Science Treatment Act. That's good, huh? Introduced by Lamar Smith, who's the chairman of the House Science Committee and a committed serial denier of climate change. The bill would limit the science used by EPA to science that is publicly available and reproducible. Nah, that sounds great. Publicly available and reproducible. The problem is that the EPA makes regulations based on careful scientific review that is reviewed by other scientists, including through a science advisory board. But a lot of science that they use, for example, on health impacts of lead or mercury or other toxics, is based on confidential health data, where they use demographic data, right? They use summarized demographic data, but they're not allowed by law to release confidential health information about individuals. And what this means in its intent is to therefore exclude public health data based on studies where you'd have to respect confidentiality of individual cases would not be admissible for the EPA to use in its development of science-based, evidence-based regulations. Now, no one would know that by just hearing the title. It sounds so benign and, well, of course. But that's just one of multiple examples where, and you kind of think about this as this pent up desire on the part of certain members of Congress and vested interests, folks, corporates, companies who are opposed to regulations because of perceived costs, notwithstanding the cost of public health of not having those regulations, to push these forward now in this perceived window of opportunity. I just want to highlight, though, that. Sort of our job is to help push back, and there are a variety of ways to do that. So, for example, these also have to pass the Senate. There are a number of senators who are swing votes, And we work, and we're not the only ones, but we work with scientists and other constituents in their states to help make sure that they're aware of this legislation, of its impacts and consequences, and that they're meeting with their members of Congress in order to encourage them to do what I would consider the right thing. Now, this is a value proposition, right? It's about advocating for science to have a seat at the table and for science not to be misrepresented. And we work with scientists who want to advocate. And I entirely agree with David's earlier point about being really, it's really essential to distinguish what you know from what you believe. But I think it's also legitimate for scientists as citizens, not like when you get your PhD, you lose your citizenship, right? to be able to say, look, I'm an expert in this topic. I also, as a citizen, care about the drinking water of my kids or the kids in Flint, Michigan, or wherever it may be. And I want to make sure that science is fairly and appropriately valued in policymaking. And so that's what we do in this context, to try to make sure that at the moment, in its constitution, in its current embodiment, that the Senate does not follow suit with the House, which is pushing forward many of these and passing quite insidious regulations.
You may wonder why I haven't said anything about climate change. The reason is that, from my perspective, it is totally political, the whole subject. And for an outsider who actually has seen data on both sides, I just don't know what to do about it. It's beyond my comprehension, because I'm not a climate scientist. So I try to keep out of it.
There's a lot of questions on this theme. I'm getting questions on my phone. I'm not like texting friends. I'm doing this panel.
So why do you have those pictures of cats then?
I need to have something to smile about. Come on. So I do have one promise for you all. We're going to end it. There's an optimistic questions. So I'm hoping that we can end on kind of a positive note. And I'll tell you now, it's what we can do. You know, what can the public do? So we'll do that one last. So there's been several pretty funny ones. So what is it with climate deniers? One person asked, is it mental illness? Is it money? This is on the card. So, we talked about money a lot. And I don't know if that's something you want to talk about. The other was... Dr. Kahn at Yale, I think I'm pronouncing his name right, has shown that confirmation bias actually just gets worse the more information. We now have this, you have designer news. Whatever you choose to believe, you can go find, confirmation for it. So how can scientists deal with that?
I've got one thing to say about that. I've been really wondering about the term science denier. I think maybe we should retire that term. And I think it's an entirely accurate description of the mindset, and it's an intense thing to say because it's historically resonant with Holocaust denial. I mean, that's an implicit comparison. And there's some relevance there. You're taking some established expertise and that's important to humanity, and you're just saying, oh no, we believe something different. And he's like, you can't, history is history and science is science. So, I mean, it's an accurate term and a strong term. But the reason why I think maybe we should retire it is because part of the answer to this question of how should we deal with it is by listening and trying to understand. And it's a term that prevents that. There are a whole course host of reasons why people are not... why people, now I'm trying to think of the right term, because I'm going to say why people are climate deniers. And skeptics isn't the right term. We invented deniers because we didn't like calling them skeptics, because they're the opposite of skeptics in a certain sense. Disbelievers, whatever. There's a whole host of reasons. Some of them are just blatant dishonesty, greed amongst people that want to keep the fossil fuel profits going. But there's a lot of people who genuinely believe that aren't greedy. They're misinformed, and they live in this other information universe. And obviously, we have this problem with polarization and different, countries within our country here. And it's incumbent upon us to try to reach across those boundaries and listen and understand where people are coming from. I think that's a big part of how we approach this. And so maybe we should think about the language we use and not use language that is sort of inherently saying, you're an evil idiot, and therefore, and I'm superior to you, and I'm, and just think we should really try not to just turn off conversation and be mindful of the language we use.
Yeah, I think that's important, David. And I would struggle to figure out what another language is, just as you were, and that's probably a good conversation to have. It's also just on the case of climate. It's, you know, so in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when climate change and the evidence of climate change was just coming into the public fore, when Jim Hansen testified before Congress, the notion that climate change was not just a scientific piece of possible future changes, but that the evidence was beginning to emerge from the noise of natural climate variability. That was on the front page of the New York Times. It was, the Vice President, first George Bush, running for office in 1988, went out and said multiple times on the campaign trail, I'm going to fight the greenhouse effect with the White House effect. It was, and early polling all through the mid-1990s was that there was no partisan divide over the concern that was fairly widespread, but not necessarily deep, but widespread about the issue. It was not a partisan issue. And it became polarized as a consequence of a significant disinformation campaign that has been well documented. We could talk about it if you'd like. And it did play into people's filters that Dan Kahan, the psychologist at Yale, has so wonderfully documented. So there are individual reasons why we selectively are attracted to evidence that fits with our values and worldview. And it's not only people on one end of the political spectrum for which that is true, right? Let's be really clear about that. So let's use another example of vaccines and autism. All right? Vaccines and autism is not a left-right issue. People who reject the evidence that the unbelievably clear scientific evidence that vaccines do not increase the risk of autism do not fit into a partisan, same partisan buckets that people do on climate change. So we should not be perceiving ourselves as superior to somebody else because we all have to pay attention to the filters with which we bring to information and be careful to look at information as carefully and objectively as possible. It's tough to do. I would say, though, on climate change, and this does get to a piece of optimism, that a lot of the differing worldviews on the ends of the spectrum are, I would argue, pretty well locked in. People reject or they accept. There's a middle, and there's an important middle, and those are places where you can have evidence-based conversations. It's hard to figure out how to do that in a large-scale way, but there are lots of kind of small-scale efforts to do so. I'm happy to talk about some of them. But I also think that while there's a divide on climate change, whatever one we can talk about, the reasons for that and the nature of where the evidence really is, there's quite broad and deep bipartisan or cross-partisan support for clean energy. Right? And you see this at multiple levels of society, in members of Congress, at state levels. There's tremendous recognition or interest in clean energy. We work a little bit with folks in Arizona with a group that's really interested in having expanded policies to put solar energy on rooftops, led by Barry Goldwater Jr. Right? No flaming liberal. His frame of reference and the folks with whom he works is not about climate, or it's about energy choice. They want to be able to make their own decisions about what sources of energy they get. And it's perfectly appropriate. And so in talking with them, we don't sit down and talk about climate change. We talk about shared interest in clean energy. You got to start where people are and work with them on common ground in order to achieve goals that you share, even if you use different language and values to get you to those goals. And I think that that value of clean energy, which is in no small part a function of the changing economics, as well as policies, including state policies to promote renewable energy, is a really important camel's nose under the tent in order to motivate actions consistent with limiting climate change, even if they're not motivated by a shared concern about the risks.
I will say something about climate change.
Okay.
I agree with what
David
has said. use of the word denier, I regard as an insult for those people, and I count myself amongst those who are not convinced that we know everything there is to know about climate change. That there are areas where, in the middle, as you were saying, where we don't know everything. But at the other extreme, some people are saying, well, there's consensus. Well, anybody who tells me there's consensus in any area of science is not talking science. Because no matter at every point in your career, you realize that, oh, now I know it, and then later you realize you didn't know it. So on the one hand, saying consensus, or the other hand, saying denier, I regard as equally irrelevant. And if I say here today that I think there might still be things to be learned about this, to explain this very, I mean, I don't deny that climate changes, that's always happened. And it appears to be happening now, but the explanation, the theory, and so on, if I'm not convinced yet, I find being called a denier an insult. I'm not denying that it exists, I'm just denying that, never mind.
Garrett, you're making an important point, and if I can just quickly respond, is that all right? Because it's important to have this dialogue. So, I don't know you well enough to know what I understand that your set of understandings about the science of climate change. And so I would certainly apologize if I or someone else used that label based on what you just said to imply your understanding.
That.
No, that's important. However, I would apply that label to the chair of the House Science Committee.
Yeah,
well,
he's the science
And I would do that unabashedly because his motivations are political. And his statements and misstatements from his perch are egregious. In terms of what he's not seeking to get better understanding. Right. He's not seeking to promote research to reduce uncertainties. Yeah. He's seeking to avoid having to address the problem.
Yeah. Now, and if you've sat in his office and had a conversation with him, which I actually have, you realize that he actually knows a lot of science, which reinforces what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have a really short answer to one of these questions. Why is climate change a political divide in the United States only and nowhere else in the world? And the answer is campaign finance. So,
yeah. Well, it's not historically that's not true. There have been other places where it's been, of course, science has been highly politicized. And the result is, though, that always ultimately science wins over politics in the sense that you can't enforce scientific truth that doesn't actually conform to what science tells us. And this is, by the way, you said we're seeking optimism. I'm optimistic that in the long run, the truth wins with science. And there's some cases, there's a famous case in the history of Soviet biology, we call Lysenkoism, where there was a biologist named, I think, Trofim Lysenko, and he had this idea that was contrary to evolutionary theory that was basically that you could control evolution of organisms simply by controlling their environment. Interestingly, we've learned in some regards the truth is more complex, and there's some ways in which that's a tiny bit true, we know now. But he had this very extreme theory that was contrary to biology of the time, but Stalin loved it because it conformed to dialectical materialism and the idea that humans could be perfected by putting them in a certain environment. He liked it politically, so they made that the policy of the Soviet Union, that this was the biology that would be taught and the research that would be pursued based on this flawed theory. It was an ideological decision that science would be done in a certain way and taught in a certain way that was wrong, and other biologists knew it was wrong. Well, the effect was that it set back Russian biology by a generation, and biology in the rest of the world went on, and we now regard that as a weird historical cul-de-sac. They were not able to change physical reality because they liked it. It's the same thing with climate change. Ultimately, you can't politically control science. Science will keep being science and finding its own truth, which isn't to say that it's not dangerous to set it back and it will do damage, but it did damage in the Soviet Union. It helped lead to famine because their agriculture was flawed because it was based on this theory. So it can do damage. I think in the long run, science and truth will win. But, and that gives me hope. But in the meantime, we've got a problem.
Here's a really great question by a student to kind of carry on the same vein. Is it okay for scientists to withhold information and discoveries to protect themselves from public upheaval?
No.
I'd actually love to know if the student is here, what she or he had in mind. Is it possible to, I'm really interested in that question.
It was an app sent in questions. I don't know if they're, I know a couple of students had to leave for class. I saw them bug out it. But if no one wants to identify themselves. So the ethics of, like you said before, people are going to start worrying every time they do a press release how it's going to be used.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to think about this in the abstract, but I'm sort of asking, is there science that's so dangerous in its implications that it should not be publicized, or at least put into the peer-reviewed literature?
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
There have been some cases where, there have been a couple cases where, somebody had, there was a question of whether they should publish the genome of, I'm trying to remember what it was, but it was a way to make a bioweapon that could basically, wipe out all life on Earth. Something not nice.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a good example. Should that be published? So there are some, you can come up with challenging cases where you might argue that it's not good to tell everybody what you know.
I know there's been some ethical dilemmas around cloning and what's happening there, so that be another example. What advice do you have for young scientists trying to enter a field in this political climate? How are young people supposed to continue climate science without available funding to enter the field?
Well,
and I'm going to blend that with another great question. How long do you see, if you assume with this premise, how long do you see it'll take for science to recover from this current situation?
Well, so let's be clear. The funding has not yet been cut. Right? We have budget proposals that have come forward from the administration. They have to go through a congressional process, appropriations process, that's a process which is going to play out over the next several months, and I wouldn't make any assumptions. I certainly don't have a crystal ball as to what the outcomes are going to be. Certainly, major areas of federal climate science funding and other federal science funding are at risk, and that would have implications for not just scientists and federal agencies, but scientists who are funded by the federal government and through NSF grants and postdoctoral grants and so on, and undergraduate and graduate training. So it could have a very significant impact in the near term. There are many other sources of funding, private philanthropies and others. But I would really encourage anybody who is interested in a field of science, whether it be climate science or any other field, and that is their interest and passion. We need you. We need people who are motivated to understand the world, to participate in the process, and get their graduate training and work to find ways to employ their expertise, which doesn't necessarily have to be, as you see here, in a narrowly defined traditional academic career path, although that's certainly a valid and important one. We are in a moment, I don't think, just as the as we've seen different ways in which science has been treated in previous administrations and Congresses, I don't think we should assume that that where we are today is where we'll be 3 to 5 years from now, maybe even a couple years from now. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But I think it's really essential that we not have the concerns that we all share, at least a lot of people I talk to share, about funding cuts and efforts to clamp down on important science lead us to act in ways that reduce our own, sort of to feed into that, right? That's really essential, that we continue to find ways to encourage people to participate in the scientific process, because we really need folks to engage. We can't afford to lose good capacity.
Yeah, I agree completely. Don't lose heart. Don't give up. We need you now more than ever. It is true that these funding cuts haven't become real. We're going to work against them. It's not true there hasn't been any damage because, you know, the hiring freeze is already in effect. And, I mean, I actually know a young woman that has never met her, but we're Facebook friends, and we've been communicating for a long time, and I think that she regards me as maybe a bit of a mentor. And she just finished her PhD, and she had a job offer for the EPA, and the paperwork hadn't been finalized. And literally, her career dreams vanished with the hiring freeze, and now she's struggling and trying to find something. So, you know, people are being damaged right now. Careers are being damaged, and, you know, it's not it's dangerous. It's scary. But on the other hand, our scientific enterprise certainly hasn't evaporated. Most of it hasn't hit yet. Maybe it won't. And I actually believe there's potential for us to not just go back to the way we were before this administration, but maybe even shoot far in the other direction. There's this potential slingshot effect where there's a rousing now of concern, and people who were sort of concerned but thinking, they got it, we're fine. Now everybody's really realizing we're not fine. It's possible that this is the last gasp of, you know, the old white rich guys who want to keep pumping oil and screwing the rest of us. Who knows? But but it's possible this is the last gasp of something, and that the slingshot's being pulled in one direction, and it's our obligation to try to release it and fire it in the other direction. And I think that's actually possible.
Well, the hiring freeze was just canceled the other day. I read it in the paper, in the Washington Post. But I do want to, we talked about this in our other panel, David. The outlook for new students is not great. And it has nothing to do with funding. It just has to do, there are too many people wanting to do science. I'm talking from the astronomy point of view. There's too many students graduating with PhDs who now have to go through two or three postdocs before they even have a hope of getting a job. By then they're about 40 years old. And that's really tough. And this is not being confronted head on either by the universities, who should exercise birth control over the number of PhDs they produce. And we can, this was something we discussed the other day, and we could have another whole panel on this, but that is a problem. It's the American Astronomical Society is now so much bigger than it used to be, but the funding for astronomy hasn't gone up like the number of astronomers that are now trying to get jobs. It's just tragic.
Can I ask, by show of hands, how many people know about the Science March that we mentioned earlier? So that's great. That's really great that most of you do. So just to be clear, so scientists as a category of humans are not typically marchers, right?
This is true.
It's a definite, you know, man bites dog kind of thing.
There's going to be sunlight.
And scientific institutions like the American Association for the Advancement of Science and other scientific societies are, you know, do not like being activists. It's just not part of the culture. And because of the moment we're in, a very broad swath of very kind of socially conservative, I can use that phrase, institutions and members and scientists from all walks of life and disciplines are going to be out marching and holding signs and probably wearing lab coats they don't otherwise wear. I know I've been there. I have a lab coat I use only for this purpose. And it's a beautiful thing. And it's a necessary thing at this moment in time, in my view. And but what's also necessary about it, again, in my view, is that it not be a march by scientists. It be a march that celebrates science. And that it's... Thank you. And that if it's just a bunch of folks like us in lab coats, it's kind of missing the point. It's really about making a public statement in a powerful way about the value of science to our society, and people who benefit from science, which I would say are all of us, need to be out there too. If the ratio is too many scientists to non-scientists, I think we've kind of lost. So if you don't have something better to do, and you're in a city, it might be, D.C. is the center of gravity for this, but there are lots of satellite marches going on. I'll be at one in Boston. So take a look.
There's one in Denver.
Great. Yeah. I'm glad to hear there's one in Denver. So you don't need a lab coat. You just got to show up, and I want to encourage you to do so.
I'm going to combine. We've got about 10 minutes left. I'm going to combine a couple of questions into a topic we haven't talked about yet. Please discuss the role of organized religion in inhibiting acceptance of scientific evidence. And then there was another question, sort of the opposite. How much potential do you think there is of changing people's mind through Pope Francis and his encyclical about climate change, and evangelicals who purport to be good stewards of the earth? So there's one that was a little more negative view, the other one a little more positive. But I know you're scientists, but how do you feel that the role of religion comes into this?
Well, organized religion, of course, is all over the map. And there are organizations within organized religion who have taken a confrontational view towards some established science. Obviously, there's the evolution-creation debate. And there are also important and large organizations amongst organized religion who are allies to scientists and to concerned people in the effort to address issues like climate change. And E.O. Wilson wrote a book, a really interesting book, which was basically, I'm trying to remember what it was called, maybe one of you guys remembers. It was not that one. It was one of the, he writes a lot of books, but it was specifically written, this one, as an appeal to evangelicals, because he, as a youth, was an evangelical, about the value of caring for creation and appealing to their religious sentiment. And of course, you know, the Pope has been vocal about this in a pro-science and positive way. So I don't think we should necessarily, as scientists, regard religion as the enemy here. I mean, this is a whole other topic we can have a panel on. But certainly as on the subject of this panel, the derailing of science by politics, one way to reach across this divide, this polarized divide, is to appeal to the values of people who may have different spiritual affiliations, but there's a broad swath of humanity that cares about the planet they live on and want their children to grow up in a place that's safe and is not in declining environmentally. And so I think those religious sentiments are ones that are powerful and can be appealed to and channeled, as well as just opposed by scientists.
Totally agree. A friend and colleague of mine is a woman named Catherine Hayhoe, who's a professor at Texas Tech and an evangelical. And she's also just a brilliant communicator of science. And she's spent a lot of time in the pews talking with fellow evangelicals about values, starting with where they're coming from, and you know, as a member of the same community, is able to speak in ways that I certainly couldn't. And you know, most scientists have good communication skills and values that we can identify, and whether they're in a religious context in an organized way or simply in a spiritual context, I think it's important to make that connection. I think there's nothing inherently contradictory between organized religion of any domain and valuing science.
Garrett, going back to your opening remarks about the press release, there was a couple of questions around that, around the importance of science communications, and maybe being an optimist, this will be a whole new job sector. We'll have science communicators. But seriously, people are specializing in that. Garrett, do you have any thoughts on... and I think people are really interested in how you think you'll be proceeding and your colleagues will proceed as you think about how you will try to, you know, promote.
Well, I think if any of us had a silver bullet on this, we'd be, you know, we'd be employing it. But in my view, we are going to win in the sense that reality always wins. You can only deny it for so long before, like I mentioned, the Lysenkoism in the Soviet Union. It's going to be climate denialism or climate avoidance, whatever. We got to work on this. But this tendency to reject the obvious, increasingly obvious truth of human involvement in changing the climate and the necessary changes in policy and behavior that are pretty clear really now. That is going to at some point be regarded historically the same way we regard Lysenkoism, although it's going to be seem a lot worse because the consequences are a lot worse. We're going to get beyond this and through this. It's a question of how quickly and what's the damage going to be. We are transforming our energy worldwide. Solar and wind are getting cheaper. Fossil fuels are ultimately on their way out. It's going to take way too long, clearly, and there's going to be a certain amount of damage and displacement and harm. And so it's a matter of the rate at which we win and how much damage can we avoid. We're not going to avoid it all. But in the long run, I'm optimistic because the truth will win. And we are going to transform our society in a way where our energy systems are not destroying our climate. I'm certain of that. It's just we need to hurry it up. And how do we do that? It's, you know, again, there's no obvious brilliant one-liner solution, but everything, you know, the communication is so essential, and education is so essential. And I'm very heartened by, if you look at history and predictions of the future that were made in the past, and that's partly what I did when I was at the Library of Congress a couple years ago in this project. I did a little project called A Brief History of the Future, where I looked at predictions of now from a long time ago and tried to think about that. We always project things forward in a linear way. We can't help it. I think cognitively we imagine the future as a linear extrapolation of trends now. But of course, history doesn't work that way. There are tipping points, not just in climate systems, but there are tipping points in human culture and human system too. And changes in consciousness, that's really what we're talking about, can be sudden. And you can reach a point where it just becomes obvious to enough people that we have to act on this. And you can only ignore the truth for so long. And I believe that is what's coming in this country and in our society.
Closing remarks?
So, well, it's a great place to end and a challenging one. Look, in my work and my, I spend a lot of time thinking politically and strategically about how scientists in particular can help push back. But, of course, there's roles for all of us to play. I know for myself, I'm trying to be more intentional about getting out of my echo chamber, right? That is to talk to people who bring different values, come from different experiences, live in places that are not, you know, in the bluest of zip codes in my case, and I would suspect here as well. And I think, you know, and to not allow through those conversations, to be respectful in those dialogues, to find places of common ground, and then talk about why I believe what I do and what the role of science is in forming those beliefs. I need to do a lot more of that, and I think there are lots of ways that all of us can look for opportunities to do that and help avoid the normalization of misinformation as the place that we unravel to. I agree in the long run we'll get past this. In the long run, of course, the climate may change quite dramatically in a way that will not be commensurate with the pace of the social change that will happen, but for our intentionality about it. And I think it's really essential that we all look for ways to break out of our echo chambers, talk about the values of science and evidence for the ways in which we look at the world to others, try to help them look for ways to connect with people outside of their bubbles, and also vote. We're all citizens, so make sure to vote.
In our last minute, Garrett, I want to make sure you have a chance to...
Yeah, the answer to that one question that a student had about how to play a role, education, of course, is incredibly important, so continue with that. But try and broaden your education just out, not just inside your narrow field. Quite frankly, I will end on a negative note. It's not out of the question that we could slip into a dark age again, because we really don't know what the future holds, which is why I've written about asteroid impacts, which worry me more than probably anything else. And now global climate change may well be pushing us over an edge. So what can you do? I think the best thing is to stay as informed as possible and do whatever you can to help. But I cannot predict the future.